I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. In 1773, around the age of 20, Phyllis Wheatley, a slave, became the first African-American to publish a book of poetry. Poems on various subjects, religious and moral, received international acclaim, yet she was enslaved. A new collection of poetry from the writer and artist Alison Clark Phyllis introduces readers to Wheatley. We get a sense of her remarkable talent, as well as the conditions in which she endured. I'll get Ms. Clark, who joins me now, to tell us about Wheatley and the poetry in this collection. Most are inspired by Wheatley. Some are written from the viewpoint of black intellectuals and entrepreneurs who have been inspired by her. Alison Clark is also the author of the Sisterhood series and winner of the Diversity Magazine Award for Writer of the Year. This new book is published by University of Calgary Press. She joined me from Edmonton, Alberta, 2 weeks ago. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Alison Clark. Ms. Clark, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. When was the first time that you encountered Phyllis Wheatley?
It was a university course at the University of Alberta. My professor was Teresa Sikonik, who actually did a beautiful blurb for the book. And that was my introduction to Phyllis. So this was before I was in a master's degree program in English literature focusing on children's literature. I was at the time just taking more courses. I had already finished my degree in sociology at UVA and graduated. And I was thinking of doing an after degree in education, so I was upgrading to get into the program, which I later did, but I chose to go into a different direction and do grad school instead, which I think was a better choice for me and led me to not just getting books published. Before Phyllis was my sisterhood trilogy. I'm a fantasy author and poet, and it was connections to the Hollins University where I graduated from, with my mastery in English literature focused on children's literature that led me to getting a UK publisher for the fantasy series. And then I thought, well, I wanted to change directions. And because then I had learned, was introduced to Phyllis by Teresa, I was thinking, you know, just meditating what I would do my master's, creative writing master's thesis on. And I think Phyllis called me to do that. And so I was going to do something else, and I chose to focus on Phyllis instead, which I think was the right choice. I just think that what she was dealing with as a woman of color, not as a poet, but as a black person, are still the same issues we're dealing with as people of color centuries later. And people have been telling me that reading Phyllis, my poetry collection, is reminding them what's happening with, you know, what happened with George Floyd and the issues brought up from his death. And I would definitely say the challenges and issues she was dealing with are very much the same challenges and issues people of color are dealing with right now.
That's the thing that, as I finished the book over the weekend, if you didn't know anything about Phyllis Wheatley, the book is awfully timely, terribly timely, and there are great lessons there. You said something a moment ago that I want to get back to, and that is her work calling on you. Was that right away after reading her work that you felt that you wanted to look at her more closely and through that write about her the way you did?
I think so, because I saw what she was actually doing, and there are two camps academically that have analyzed Phyllis, and I belong to the other camp, but what she was doing, because she was a person of color, a woman of color, and a slave, she could not write out openly that she was against slavery. She referred to it in some ways, but she really had to be more incognito, because if she was more open about that stats, her life would have been in physical jeopardy. She would have been killed. Now, even though her slave masters were more kindly and all that, it doesn't matter. She's still a person of color. And I referred to that in the collection about how people of color were treated. If you were a person of color out at a certain time of night in Boston. You could be corralled up, sent to here, there. You had no freedom as a person. And she knew all about that. So your movements were under surveillance, and there are things going on. You didn't have full rights as a human being.
Yeah.
So if that stuff is going on, do you think you could openly talk about being against slavery like that? No, you couldn't. So reading her work, I saw what she was doing. It was very much an incognito thing. She did a lot of really double entendres, double wordplay, especially with things like the word patron, which can mean, you know, a benefactor to the arts, but it could also mean someone who gives a slave their freedom.
Mm.
And she chose words like that purposely because the audience that she was focusing on were very well read. Right? Back in those days, it was very well read in different types of literature, mythology, and all that. And she's hitting on all those notes. So when people are reading that, and they would know about the word patron, what it really means, and the two definitions, you know. And so she's saying, advocating for people of color and their freedom. So by using the double wordplay, the word patron, meaning benefactor of the arts, also a person who gives someone their freedom, she's clearly indicating that she's saying that slavery is wrong. But she had to do it in an incognito way. And literature, sometimes you really have to read between the lines, not just poetry, but prose too. And sometimes the omissions are the greatest clues too, what is not said. Sometimes what's not said is even more powerful than what is said.
And that's the sort of stuff that one thinks about long after they put the book down even, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
When would she write? I mean, one would assume that as a slave, that wouldn't give you much free time.
No. So even though she was delegated lighter duty, she was still a slave, so she wrote mainly at night. And that has been documented. I was reading other academic sources and stuff like that. She wrote mainly at night.
Yeah.
And I think that was her solace. I think it gave her the freedom to think and meditate. And then it gave her a chance to have a break to kind of, I'm not sure, to forget, but to give her comfort, you know, in these times where, well, she never would see her mother again or her dad again, right? Because she was ripped away from her parents. She came to Boston at 7 or 8. And that's a young time to be ripped away from your parents. And she knew in that young age she would never see her parents or her homeland ever again. Now, she never really wrote about that. She referred to one of her poems, but she really actually did not refer to her homeland specifically, did not really refer to how she really felt about what happened or anything like that. There are no journals documenting how she felt about being ripped from her homeland in such a horrible way.
Uh-huh.
It is trauma. And I do think she did not want to talk about or write about because it's just too painful. And I mentioned that one of the poems about not giving yourself away. You do what you have to do to free your people and yourself, because she knew by publishing this book of poetry, it was a gateway to her freedom. She figured out pretty quickly when she was young. She was a very smart woman and young girl. She knew what was going on. And she knew that the word was her gateway. And she knew that the people around her, even though unfortunately none were slave owners, these would be the same people who gave that gateway to her emancipation. And to be able to navigate that is not an easy thing to navigate. And I really commend her for that, too. It's a painful thing to have to work within a system that's so anti-black, really, to make something for yourself.
Indeed.
And that's what she had to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's very admirable.
Right. You know, when I talk to writers, as I have over the years, they talk about the necessity to read. Do you have any insight as to how much she would read and whether that was, I'm trying to find the connection in terms of how much she read and what she read with what she wrote, or how much she wrote even.
Well, I think she was very much versed. She was a child prodigy, so she was learning the Latin, the Greek. She learned the classics. So So she was well-versed in all the classics, the mythology, Pope, all those guys she was well-versed in, all the masters in those different areas. So she was very well-read. Libraries were her gateway, and they are for me in many ways, too. So her one benefactor, I think it's Mather Biles, who was one of her role models, too, in terms of poetry. He wrote poetry himself. I read some of his work. I saw some academic journals reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And not bad. She kind of modeled herself a little bit, but she was really doing more of her own thing. But I'd say mainly he was like a mentor, you know, introducing her to the world of books and the world of writing and poetry. But what she did was very much her own. So Mather Biles had a massive library. I think it was Hutchinson. I think he was the governor in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had Thomas Hutchinson. He had a massive library. So she just, it just how it manifested herself. She was in the milieu of people who had knowledge, who had massive libraries, Thomas Hutchinson. Mather Biles was a librarian at Harvard. He went and was a graduate of Harvard. So these are very learned people, and have access to information in books. And I think Mather Biles was a neighbor of hers, really.
Yeah.
Lived not far from each other, so it was, even physically, it was not hard to get to his place. So with this access of knowledge, the libraries. Lois was being very well-read, well-learned, went to place at Harvard University. And she has that gateway to learning, which definitely influenced her writing. And reading people like Pope and all that kind of thing, it really kind of influenced her. So she alluded to a lot of Greek mythology, especially Homer.
Mm-hmm.
Pope, I think, translated from the Greek some of his work into English. Pope is known for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mather Biles, he knew Pope, actually. They're in correspondence. You can look that up. I did research. So they knew each other. So with these gateways and people in these different areas, it all kind of influenced her work. So she's very well-versed. So, yeah, she learned Latin. She learned Greek. She learned the classics. She was from the Fulani tribe. I was doing a bit of research about that, too.
Mm-hmm.
They're known for being scientists, astronomers. One of the poems she wrote, she alluded to the solar system, you know, how the planets go around the sun.
Right.
So obviously the Fulani people were very much have the knowledge of astronomy, too, and that influenced her and that came out in her poetry. So it shows you also how all the African people from different tribes were very advanced.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with slavery and things like that, different elites want to put that kind of knowledge underground and say different tribes from African areas were backward and this and that. But there were, a lot of them were very advanced in terms of different areas, or philosophers or scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And Phyllis was a result of that. And that manifested in her work, too.
Mm-hmm.
So all these things manifested together to come out in her poetry. And I just think it's amazing how she just took to everything so young.
Yeah.
Because when she came over at 8, they knew she had a propensity for language somehow. She was writing things on the wall there. Some people say it could have been script from a different language. Who knows? But the fact that she picked up these languages, I mean, Greek, Latin are not easy language to pick up, even as an adult, really.
Yeah.
And for her to pick it up as a kid, I think it was pretty amazing, and they kind of went with that. But unfortunately, she was kind of a guinea pig, too, and there were a lot of politics with that. And unfortunately, they saw her as like the pet project, showing her off to different neighbors. Oh, she can run, our slave can do this and that. And I don't think that was easy for her either, because she lives in this gilded cage.
Right.
So I remember in one of the classes I took, she was, because she wasn't, they couldn't advocate for herself. She couldn't make her own money. I read more research that a significant number of slaves, like when their masters passed on, they would get a bit of property or money.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a question, one of the pieces I read, well, she reconsidered part of the family, because when Master John Wheatley died, he didn't leave her a cent. He didn't leave her property, he didn't leave her money, and it was not unusual for the masters to leave their slaves when they had died some kind of property or money or something. He left her nothing. So was he considered, was she considered part of the family? Not really. Right?
Yeah.
And I think she knew that. It's a hard thing to navigate when you're in a position to say, yeah, I'm part of the family, we do this, we do the education, but you're not really seen as part of the family, not really seen as a human being. You really can't make your way in the world. She should have been doing lecture tours and all these different things, like the later abolitionists did.
Yeah.
And she didn't get the chance because she didn't have the opportunity.
Yeah.
And one of the things I wrote about in those Porch Collections was having the opportunity. And as you know, I wrote from different voices.
Right.
Mm-hmm. One of the concepts was, we don't want a hand out. We want a hand up. We just want the opportunity. We just want a seat at the table.
Right.
Again, another timely... another timely lesson for us, and you know, something that we should heed. You mentioned using other voices in this collection. At one point, it also makes it relevant to today, in that the different voices that you use, like Barb Lee, for example, someone that some of us know. Was that important in terms of seeing her impact on not only different people, but different kinds of people?
I think so. It's just how it worked out. But I was reading about her. I got her autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reading that, and the main thing there was this Phyllis Wheatley Club that her mother was a member of. And I never heard of this Phyllis Wheatley Club. I had no idea. And it was basically a club for black women to join so they could network and get opportunities in terms of employment, in terms of a place to live. And the mother in blogs online that was talking about that and how it gave her opportunity. And I thought that was really interesting how Phyllis, in another way, she was reaching through time.
Yeah.
And influencing people in their 50s and her daughter in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And her influence through her writing was influencing all these different generations, which I thought was fascinating. And Barbara Lee was talking about how her mother told her about Phyllis and the importance of education, And Barbara Lee went to college, and I think she ended up doing a master's, I think, too. She went beyond, I think she went to grad school too, but she definitely did her undergrad, and I think she went to grad school, and now she's a congresswoman for many, many years now, advocating for all sorts of people, and she is Christian, but she advocates for gay people, people suffering from AIDS, all these different things, and that led me to another article about her. She went to this event at the Library of Congress, and there was some kind of collection about the stories of people and their experiences and dealing with the AIDS era and gay people suffering from AIDS and being isolated and their own family members not wanting to even touch them, see them, being treated as pariahs. And she talked about the importance of these stories and keeping it in archives and that kind of thing. So I think they're transferring it to the Library of Congress, all these archives about the experience of these people become through the AIDS era, which I found interesting. And she was reaching out to all these different people and, again, talking about the power of the story, the power of hearing the human voice, which I think, obviously, Phyllis felt very strongly about, not just in her poetry, but her life. So you have all these linkages now of Phyllis reaching through time. And the power of word, the power of people's stories and voices, even to Barbara Lee in the 2000s there, right? You have all these connections. And then her mother was influenced by Phyllis, by being part of that club, and gaining networking connections through there. She was on a mission. She did a lot of education, went to different colleges, which led her to gain different employment opportunities. And I think she said another blogger, she did it for her kids. She was doing it for her kids. She wasn't going to be a hero or a superstar. She was just doing what had to be done to give her kids opportunities. And that's another, again, the theme, giving people opportunities, giving a chance to be given the opportunity. And a lot of people are becoming trailblazers, not because they say, well, I'm going to be a trailblazer. And you know, they don't think about doing that. They're just doing what has to be done.
Right.
Because they're on a mission to change things.
Yeah.
For themselves, for their families, or for other people. Right? Getting what Phyllis was trying to do. I think she's saying up there, you know what? I'm a trailblazer, and yeah, I'm the first African-American published book poetry, yeah, and I'm going to ring through time, and yeah. I don't think she's thinking all this stuff.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
She's thinking, I want to publish this book of poetry to get my freedom.
Yeah.
I want to talk about how slavery is wrong to free my people, and it might take a while. It might not change the world immediately, but I want to put the work out there anyway. And maybe in some small way people will hear what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Indeed, indeed. I mentioned this at the beginning of just before we started talking. There's something about this collection that I enjoyed a great deal, and that is I got a real sense of who Wheatley was, even though it wasn't one of those straight-up biographies that one would expect to learn a great deal from. I read the collection first not knowing anything about her, and as I said, I got a great sense of who she was. Then I went online and read something about her, and I really do feel that I learned more from your book than what I read elsewhere. What is it about writing in the genre that you've written this book in, which is poetry, which is poetry prose, that allows, I guess, a greater place to learn about something or someone?
I think it's because you're creating worlds. So I'm a fantasy author, too. I do different genres like a lot of writers. Oh. And when you create a world, it's 3D. Mm. And when you're creating a world, you're able to encapsulate and connect the dots in a better way than I would say like a more conventional biography. Because you're putting in different elements, how the person's thinking or feeling, how their actions connect to other people's actions. I've always said that we don't work or live alone. What we do all influences, impacts on other people. We're all part of a chain. And it is that in physics, for every action, there's a reaction.
Uh-huh.
Well, in the world, when someone does something, there's always some kind of reaction to it. And I think with Phyllis, in creating a world, and I'm not really, I didn't purposely think to do that, just that's what I do. When creating a world, that's what I need to do for Phyllis, that's 3D. I just able to connect these different things, how she was feeling, the obstacles she had to come across, the people she met, like Math or Biles, beautiful library. I just had a feeling. I knew she loved libraries. I knew. And then when I was doing the research on Math or Biles in a library and Thomas Hutchins in a library and all these significant men had really massive libraries, a lot of very highly educated, went to Harvard and so on. It wasn't a coincidence that connection to those worlds would influence her, really. Mm-hmm. And my putting in poetry the way I did and different voices makes it more 3D. And it was, for me, it's more organic. I'm not rethinking, okay, I'm going to do it this way. I'm not rethinking that way. I think a lot of writers don't rethink that way. I'm just thinking that's what it was meant to be for the collection, and it's manifested itself organically. And having a different voice, you have Booker T. Washington in there, and you know, John Lewis in there, helped found the Tuskegee Institute, which is now at Tuskegee University,
yeah.
And all these different voices that were influenced. So Booker T, I know, was influenced by Phyllis, and all these other people were influenced by Phyllis. And it's just interesting, the whole trajectory, and I know that she never thought that she would have such an impact, but she did. But in writing and literature, you can do that. You create these worlds, and it's 3D, connect this person to that person. And you might not be doing it consciously, mm-hmm. but it just happens organically. And you see that you're like, oh, okay, she influenced this person. And then this person influenced the other person. And then this person influenced this other person. It's like a chain reaction. So when this happened and this happened, okay. And so this person was really influenced by the word, but also how it's important to hear human voices. And so this person ended up at the Library of Congress, and they're talking about the sadness of during the time of AIDS, and how people didn't feel heard, and they felt really not advocated for. And this Barbara Lee was advocating for everybody. As a black person, she knew that's important. But she also knew through people like Phyllis, hearing the human voice is very important. And then I'm going to quote from Dr. King saying, well, riots, that's the language of the unheard.
Mm.
When you are unheard and manifest in disturbing ways, it's important for the human voice to be heard. Oprah Winfrey talked about that. People just want to be heard. And when you put it in poetry and other things, that's a way to get the word out there. And I'm glad I was a part of that. I think she spoke to me. I think where she is in the celestial realm, she's happy. And I think now people like me are seeing what she was actually doing and that she was advocating for her people as well as herself and that she was anti-slavery. And I think she's at peace. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, when she died, in terms of human being, she died alone.
Mm-hmm.
Alone with a child out of breast, which is a horrible way to die. It haunts me still.
Yeah.
I know she had angels and ancestors, and that's beautiful, but she should have had at least one human being there, and she had nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody. For all the stuff that she achieved, she had nobody.
Yeah.
And I think that's heartbreaking still for me.
Indeed, yeah. Allison, this is a marvelous collection. I enjoyed reading it a great deal. I appreciate your time today, and thanks for this.
Well, thank you.
The book is called Phyllis. It is published by University of Calgary Press. It's author Allison Clark. Join me on the line from Edmonton, Alberta, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.